This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on October 21st, 2009, and we're talking to Phil Hack.
It's good to be on, guys. What do you guys want to ask me? What do you have?
Well, the obvious thing is ASP.NET MVC2. So, yeah, that's cool. Do you want to give us some laundry lists of great, awesome things?
Sure. So, we just released Preview 2, and just this week we released Visual Studio 2010 Beta 2, which includes MVC2 in the box. So, that's a great thing. So, you can build, you know, if you're playing around with Visual Studio 2010, you don't have to go and do a separate download. Unfortunately, you can't run your ASP.NET MVC 1.0 projects in Visual Studio 2010, but you can run your MVC 2 Preview 2 projects in there. And one thing, I wrote a blog post, I think just last night, that kind of discusses some of those issues. But one of the cool things that I think will be interesting to try out and see how people react to it is that if you're running your MVC2 application on ASP.NET 4, we have this new code block syntax. So if you do %:, instead of %= it will HTML encode the output. However, we also introduced a brand new interface into ASP.NET 4 core called the iHTML string. And we also have a concrete type for convenience that implements that interface called the HTML string. So if you're writing a method that returns HTML that you've properly sanitized yourself as the author of the method, then you don't want it to get encoded by this %:, syntax. So you can have the return type be HTML string or iHTML string. So our goal with this new syntax, the %:, is that if you're writing MVC apps or just any kind of apps where you're doing inline view output, we would like it so that you don't have to worry about it. You just use it all the time, right? %:, is your way, is basically the new response.write. But the only way we can really make that work is if we don't encode stuff that shouldn't get encoded. So, for example, if you think about MVC with the HTML.text box, that returns a block of HTML text that we're already telling you is properly encoded. So if you wouldn't want to call HTML.encode on that because it's already encoded, you'd get double encoded output. So what we did with ASP.NET 4 is we included in the core of ASP.NET 4 a new interface called iHTML string. And if a method returns that or a type that derives from that, that implements that interface, we're not going to HTML encode that. And this is kind of nice because if you as a library author or you as an application developer who are writing your own HTML helper methods, you can have your type return this interface and you can just basically express your intent to the framework saying, you know what, this HTML is sanitized. For convenience, we also have an HTML string class that just happens to implement that for the cases that, you know, you just want to return a string and you just wrap it in HTML string and you're done. So, you know, like my goal with that is that all new samples building on top of ASP.NET 4. So this won't work on ASP.NET 3.5, of course, because, you know, the runtime changes were in the new framework. But moving forward, you know, you should almost never see %= ideally. And then that we can relegate that to as almost like obsoleting that and making that a bad memory. And so, you know, for the next generation of web developers, like when my son becomes a web developer, should he choose, while he's playing soccer for Real Madrid or Barcelona or Man U, next generation will think of HTML encoding as the default mechanism when response.writing.
That's cool. Yeah, I think that you pointed out the not double encoding stuff is a tricky thing that a lot of people overlook, where it's just like, well, why don't you encode everything? And then you run into that problem.
Right. So all of our helpers in MVC return this new type called MVC HTML string. And there's a bit of a story behind why it's that type that I'll either share on my blog or share later. But so when you're running MVC on ASP.NET 4, that type will implement this interface, and thus you can use it with the new syntax. Now, unfortunately, we didn't have time to change, you know, all our default view templates to use this new syntax for preview 2, but you will see it when we come out with the next version for ASP.NET 4.
Speaking of view templates, I know there were some new view templates for preview 1. Is there anything new with that in 2?
I'm sorry.
I'm talking about the display 4 and editor 4 and that kind of stuff.
In preview 2, we had a lot of improvements. I don't know if we added any new ones other than like the editor for model and display for model overloads, which are just for the common case where you want to display the current model versus displaying a property of the current model. One thing we did add, though, was more extensible validation and metadata in preview 2 so that you can hook in things like if you don't want to use data annotations for doing validation, but you want to use maybe the enterprise application validation block, you can hook that in. And Brad Wilson has a great blog post on it. I think your guys' notes for guests on your show is that it's required to mention Brad Wilson in every interview. So I just wanted to make sure I got that out there. But in any case, if you read Brad Wilson's blog post on hooking in enterprise application validation library, you'll see that it's very extensible for hooking in your own validation systems when you're doing model binding. Also, we have a client validation that you can now enable, and that builds upon the metadata that's on the server side and kind of floats it up to the client side, much like Xval. Pretty much Xval was the inspiration for that feature by Steve Sanderson, who's quite the MVC ninja.
That in a way is kind of similar to like Rhea services in that it floats the validation stuff based on annotations or other things all the way to the client and then validates on both client and server.
Yeah, conceptually it's very similar.
And so are there, as far as validation rules, like you can do them via data annotations, are there other ways you can override, like with via code or via XML or something like that?
Yeah, so there's multiple levels of extensibility for the validation metadata. So we have this model metadata and we have this validation providers. So for validation, you could override the most base level class, which means you're going to do all the work. But by doing so, you could actually have your validation come from the database, XML, whatever. We'll probably not include, you know, any examples of that in the box, but you can. Then there's another level where, let's say you just have alternative attributes, then you can, derive from another class that will allow you to hook in your own attributes. So we'll start off with validation for the base data annotations, but in our futures library, we plan to have, or we do have, support for some of the new data annotations that are coming in ASP.NET 4. So one tricky thing about this release is that we're compiling the assembly, the system.web.mvc, against ASP.NET 3.5 SP1. And that's the one true MVC DLL that we're distributing for both 3.5 and for 4.0. We're not doing any conditional compilation. We didn't want to get into this headache of trying to manage the same version across two different framework versions. So we decided that we would ship this one version. So the point there is that's why, like, in the box, we won't have support for the new data annotations in .NET 4 because, you know, those aren't in ASP.NET 3.5 SP1. But in our futures library, we'll have support for those new annotations. So if you want to use those new annotations if you're building an MVC 2 app on ASP.NET 4, you can just go to our futures library and we'll have some support there for you.
As you're bringing up the futures library, was a lot of this driven off of stuff that was in futures or, you know, the biggest client requests, or is this just kind of evolution of where the product kind of seemed to be going?
So this particular version is, we try to come up with these themes and we have this like very vague theme, enterprise. But really to us, it sort of was like, you know, productivity. And sort of the grand scheme of things, we're also thinking about like, well, what have we done in web forms that would be cross-cutting into MVC and vice versa? So if you'll notice with ASP.NET 4, for example, we implemented routing for web forms. So now you can use routings with your normal pages. At the same time, we're taking these dynamic data-like features and moving them into MVC. But we're kind of doing an MVC twist on them, right? Like, so we're not taking the exact dynamic data features, but basically the templated helpers with their field templates are very similar to what we did in dynamic data. And in fact, Brad Wilson worked on both teams. So there you can see where the inspiration for that comes in. So I think, there's that aspect of it. We have this vision, that this is all ASP.NET. It's just different flavors of how you develop apps for ASP.NET as a platform. But there's also, we're also trying to listen to, frequent customer requests where people are running the pain points and trying to address the most particular one. And it's interesting which ones will get like a lot of praise when they're really like simple things we probably should have done all along. So one of the things some people will be happy about is that we're going to include in the next version, in our next preview, we're going to include an empty MVC project. So that won't have, all the extra stuff that comes with the default project template. So I'm pretty, I'm excited about that because I think that's something I would use.
Well, that's in the beta, isn't it? Beta 2? I think, yeah.
Oh, no. So that empty for ASP.NET web forms is in there, but empty for MVC is not.
Pretty sure. No, you're right.
I hope I'm right.
Well, I'm trying to remember. I did install it.
What?
I did install the beta 2 today, and I remember starting up an MVC2 project, but I thought it did. I didn't remember it having the home and account controllers in there, but now I think it did, yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it did.
Wasted time there for no reason.
That's okay.
But I mean, if you look at the blank web forms project or ASP.NET app web application project, you can get the gist of what we're looking at. I mean, ours won't be as blank because we need to have certain directories in the right place, but it will be pretty much akin to that. Very minimal web.config and very minimalist project template.
So speaking of minimal web.config, I noticed that's kind of a big theme. So that basically pushes all the default stuff into a base web.config. Is that the idea?
The machine level web.config.
That's something that had been around for a while. I remember with ASP 1.1 and stuff watching and moving to 2.0, watching stuff move into the machine config. Is that just kind of continuing that process of saying like, okay, everybody's using, these basic services, let's just move them over?
Yeah, one of the aspects that they want to be sure about before they do that is performance, because once it's in the root one, then it affects every single application on the machine. So that's why like some of these things weren't moved in there earlier. And it's kind of interesting. I was reading some article about Windows 7. It's a slight tangent here, but and they're talking about how this seems to be the year of just coming out with releases that are just focused less on adding more features and more on streamlining, right? Like, so Snow Leopard, focused almost exclusively on performance and getting at the low-hanging fruit of little things that, kind of aggravate people. Windows 7 is kind of like taking Vista and just, fixing all the problems and streamlining it. It still runs on the same system requirements as Vista does. So in some ways, I see ASP.NET 4 doing a lot of that kind of work, where we're like, oh, let's look at all the cruft in web.config. Okay, people have complained about this. Let's streamline it. Let's make it slim. Okay, what are other complaints people had? Web controls, they produced this ugly markup. Okay, let's fix that. So we went through all the web controls, and we cleaned up the markup and to produce more semantic markup where you had the ability to fully style and control the markup. And we also, fixed the CTL 001 dollar sign PLC 001 dollar sign ID, client ID issue.
So obviously you've got to by changing the markup you're rendering, you've got to manage the backward compatibility with that to make sure that everything's kind of opt in with this stuff, right? Like you opt into ASP4, you opt into the cleaned up markup. Is that the idea?
So if you're building a brand new ASP.NET 4 app, it's all turned on by default. And the way it's turned on is there's a, I wish I could remember the exact name, rendering compatibility flag or something along those lines. You know, I always forget the name, but you can look it up online. And so since an existing 3.5 or ASP.NET 2 app would not have this new flag in config, they don't get the new rendering, they get the old rendering. So, you know, basically a lot of these controls, we sort of just split the rendering code. And so if you have this flag, you get the new rendering. And if you don't have this flag, you get the old rendering. Now, I actually was the PM for the menu control. So that was the only one I worked on very closely with the team. And so that if you ever open up a 3.5 app and put out a menu control and then view source, you'll probably be disgusted by what you see. I mean, it's just a bunch of tables, you know. I mean, when it was written like 20 years ago or however many years ago, you know, it was, you know, maybe not such a bad thing, but definitely in this day and age, you know, it's not what we'd consider par for doing a proper menu in a web app. So what we did was we created a new rendering path where we would render an unordered list and list elements. So, you know, in other words, UL and LI elements. And, you know, with semantic markup, tried to add the area accessible RIA metadata and just overall just have clean markup, you know, cleaned up the JavaScript that you know, makes that menu control work. It was actually kind of fun to, you know, get to work on something other than MVC for a little bit.
So what if I wanted to use and break my MVC application into multiple sub-projects?
Break your MVC application into multiple sub-projects?
He's asking about areas.
Okay. So...
It was supposed to be a leading question that you just jumped right on.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what you're talking about, man.
What the hell?
So areas is a new feature of MVC 2 that's really, a lot of people are kind of seeing it as the new component model, but we're sort of not ready to call it that just yet. It's more inspired by sort of the monorail areas where, or MERP slices to some degree, where we're trying to find a way to organize a large project in a way that makes it easier to develop it. So, you know, if you have 100 controllers, but you can group the controllers into some logical groups, then you can use areas for that. And that grouping can also be reflected in the URLs or areas of your site. So it's not just a logical grouping. And there's two ways to do it right now. One of those ways we might be deferring back to future. So, you know, you have to stay tuned on that one, which is we have what we call single project areas and multi-project areas. And right now for multi-project areas, we have some guidelines out there, and it's a very manual process to enable that, where a single project areas works right out of the box and very cleanly.
So you said that areas can be set up to have an effect on your routing as well. How does that, is that by default or is that just something you can potentially do? Like, how does that work?
So the way it works is that when you define an area, you can have what's called an area registration file. It's a class that derives from area registration. And in there's a method that you implement to register your routes. It's actually to register the area. So there might be multiple things you need to do to register that particular area. In general, you also register your routes, and those routes will be associated to that area. And the way that works is when you're in the area, any links that you try to generate will by default also be in that area. So for example, if you try to call action link foo comma, you know, bar, like foo controller bar action, you might actually have foo controllers in multiple areas, but by default we'll only look at the routes in your current area. And then if you want to link to another area, you just pass area equals, you know, the area name, and you can link out of an area. So it creates this nice way of grouping sections of your site and not having to think about it too much when you're generating links to different, you know, controllers or actions within the same area.
Some of the obvious uses, I'd think, you know, you've got like the admin section of your site potentially, or you've got, you know, different departments in a company or something. Are there other kind of uses that you anticipate people, like logical groupings that you think would make sense?
Just like you said, I get probably an email every day saying, hey, I get this app and I got this area named blogs and I have this other area. And so like blogs, gallery, photo gallery. So bing.com/shopping, you can imagine that's actually running on that portion of the site is running on MVC. That might be an area. Yeah, I can see that happening.
So you said areas are, people are sort of thinking of it as a version of a component model, but it's not really intended to be that yet. So what is the sort of, level of encapsulation you can have with areas? I mean, can I ship you a DLL that's like a totally self-contained area that you can just drop into your application? Or, is it, consist of DLLs and ASPX files and all that has to be sort of managed, as part of my project?
Well, so there's a couple aspects to areas, right? There's the routes, controllers, and views. So right now, right out of the box, it's very easy to just simply package up your area registration, so the routes and the controllers of an area, into a separate class library project and drop it into any MVC application. And now they'll get picked up if you're calling the register all areas from the main project. So that's a very easy way to distribute. Where it gets tricky is if you're trying to distribute views as well. Now, we do have the multi-project support, but that's kind of tricky because it relies on a build task and you have to manually enable it by mucking around in the CSproj file. And it actually does a file copy of the views into the main project. Now, the way I see it, I think multi-project areas where you actually can package up the views in that same assembly would actually make more sense for a future version of MVC where we actually take a full dependency on ASP.NET 4. And the reason I say that is that one of the features coming with ASP.NET 4 is the ability to have virtual path provider work in medium trust. And this is like one where when I first joined the company, it was like one of my first questions is, okay, so can we make virtual path providers work in medium trust? Because I really need it for subtext. So I'm really happy that we can finally get that in there. I was hoping we could have got it in for 3.5 SP1, but we didn't. But for ASP.NET 4, I think build providers and virtual path providers should all work in medium trust. And the reason that's cool is that means that you can easily do embedded view engines where you just register a virtual path provider, and now you can store your views in a database and an assembly or anywhere you want to in a zip file and have it work without having to write a bunch of crazy code and have it work in medium trust. So I think it's going to be really cool, and it's going to open up a lot of these scenarios where you really want to distribute the Holy Triumvirate into an existing application via a single package.
So you just gave one example of where you're because you're trying to maintain 3.5 compatibility, there's features of 4.0 that you're not taking advantage of. Are there other areas, are there other aspects of 4.0 that you're not taking advantage of that you'd like to be able to, or that you're looking at for, future versions?
Yeah, the other thing that we're not taking advantage of is, I mentioned earlier, the new data annotations, dynamic keyword. I'm not necessarily sure that we would take advantage of that, but it's just something that's, now that there's a new cool toy in there, like I'm kind of wondering, is there any scenarios where it actually makes a lot of sense? And I'd actually written a blog post where I talked about one possible scenario where you have a cleaner way of accessing a view data dictionary, or really, any dictionary using dynamic keyword, which, somewhat of a controversial post because a lot of people don't like mixing dynamic and static at all. They don't want their chocolate in their cereal. Oh, and then IHTML string is a feature of 4.0 that we were able to take advantage of in 3.5 when running on 4.0, and that required a little bit of magic on our part that will be nice to not have to do.
And so going forward, is the intent that MVC2 be the last version that runs on 3.5, and then the next release will be sort of 4.0 and beyond?
Very good question, Kevin. I haven't really talked about this yet, but pretty much that's the line of thinking right now, is that MVC2 is the end of the line for ASP.NET 3.5 support for ASP.NET MVC, and that ASP.NET MVC3 will most likely only run on ASP.NET 4. That's the current line of thinking. The problem we'll run into is if we continue to try to support backcompat, then we're really going to be shackled, and it just adds a lot of overhead and complexity to the entire development process. So I really want MVC3 to be able to just look forward and focus on ASP.NET 4 and take advantage of all the great stuff that's happened in both the CLR, the BCL, and ASP.NET 4 as a whole.
Are there things using the dynamic keyword that you would like to do or think are possible that you're looking forward to when you can really completely buy in?
So the dynamic keyword, I mentioned the view data dictionary, like the clean access to the keys using like dynamic properties.
Right.
That might be one aspect. And there might be other things that we just need to play around with. Like, for example, maybe just in general dynamic language support. I have a prototype that I had worked on with some guys on my team that we kind of put out there and has been carried forward by I think Ivan Porto and others and Jimmy Schimenti, where we have Iron Ruby running on MVC. So it'd be interesting to see, like, maybe in the future if we can move that forward a little bit. The other thing in ASP or in .NET 4 that I really want to take advantage of is the name parameters to action methods. If you built an MVC app, you might notice that we have quite a few overloads to some of our helper methods. And it'd be nice if we could just cut that down by saying, here's the method that has, all the parameters you might want to pass in, and you can use the optional name parameters and specify the ones you care about. And I really like the name parameters. I mean, it's one of the things we have to be careful not to abuse it, not to have methods that take 100 parameters or anything like that. But I think in many respects, I really like that feature C# for cases where you can actually read the parameters. For example, one of the framework design guidelines tells you, instead of a bool, you might want to use an enum with two values, so that when someone's reading the call to the method, and they, instead of seeing true, which they have no idea what that means, or what that's being passed into, they would see the enum value, right? But with the name parameters, you might just say is active colon true, and then that's really readable. You know what that true is being passed into.
So I've kind of got two questions, which you may or may not be able to answer. So the first one was, one of the shots that MVC has kind of taken is that it's convention over configuration without much convention. So in other words, it supports like IOC, and it supports these kinds of things, but it doesn't come with them. Can I have to put your own in? And I was wondering if there's any plans to either, just go ahead and make a decision to adopt something like Unity or Ninject, or maybe write up an IOC container using Meph and use that, but still make it swappable. Same with the data layer, the fact that the models is always empty and there's nothing in there. I mean, I kind of understand why you did it initially, but I'm wondering now, since it's going to be shipping in 2010, not really as out of band, if it might be a good idea to throw a little bit of prescriptive guidance in there. But again, of course, models, no matter what you do, you're going to get kicked in the throat, no matter what you put in there. If it's Entity Framework or Link to SQL or in Hibernate, someone's not going to like it. But something like IOC, if it's swappable, and I'm thinking mainly in terms of some of the auto wire things like AutoFac, or the Ninject MVC one, where you just, you don't have to do all that much work. You just create your controllers, pass in your dependencies, and the base controller takes care of wiring up all that for you.
Yeah, good question. So
so my question is, you going to pull up your pants and, put on the...
Remember earlier how I was asking if you other guys can ask really questions? I take that back. Can we just go back to John asking all the questions? No. No, it's a really good question. Let me address a couple different parts, right? Let's talk about model. Like, one criticism of ASP.NET MVC I often hear is that, it's missing the M in model. And I, maybe I'm being overly nitpicky, but I kind of take exception to that because, and this maybe people, I know people will argue me with this, because I think the M is there in the sense that we have all the support for the M, right? Like we have model binders, you know, we have templated helpers, we have all these ways you can take the M and either pass it back into your action method and get validation out of it and put the validation into the view. I think when people said that ASP.NET MVC is missing the M, what they really mean is we're missing the data access. Because the M in MVC is really the model of your application, and it's your you know, domain models, and it's your view models. M is not really, you know, data access, or not only data access. But you know, but obviously, data access is how you populate your Ms, right? So, you know, I think, you know, MVC, we have the M in MVC. What we don't have is the data access built in for MVC. Now, picking one and going with it, you know, is going to be a challenge at this stage in the game. I mean, let's, you know, not pull any punches, right? However, I think the answer to that question will clear up a little bit in the future, but not in the MVC 2 timeframe. And it's not anything I can talk about at this stage, like why I think it will clear up. But, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where Microsoft has a clear data strategy, you know, in terms of entity framework. But I don't think we could put that in MVC 2 as the way to do it right now. So in the box. I mean, the thing is, we'll have guidance for doing it. And it's all built in because you're building on ASP.NET and you're building on .NET. The .NET framework, and it's already there. So I'm not sure if we, you know, what more we would want to do there to make, you know, something like that the default, or to, you know, include in Hibernate, or to, you know, include Subsonic or anything like that. I think right now, you know, for MVC 2, we're going to probably stay out of that fray. And for MVC 3, maybe address it a little more concretely. It's a real tricky question, right? And so in terms of like, not wanting to alienate anyone by doing it.
You know, it would seem like you were talking earlier about having the empty template, and it would seem like maybe that's something where you could have just different project templates.
Oh, yeah. So that's a good point. That's actually one thing we're thinking of doing even now is not in the box, but maybe in the ASP.NET website, you know, like some sort of ASP.NET/MVC, having some sort of project gallery or something like that, where we have a few project templates that are more prescriptive. So that is something that we may do. I don't know if I'm just saying we might not do anything in the box right now, but having something a little more prescriptive, for example, something like the Sharp architecture. And in fact, right now, I'd say since we don't have anything that's that prescriptive, maybe the answer is, well, you know, areas where we're not addressing the need, you know, the community is addressing the need, and so you should look at like what they've done. So I might point people to the Sharp architecture, or now there's this new MVC turbine that Javier Lozano is trying to do. So there are some solutions out there for that sort of thing. And so, like, you know, kind of going back to, you know, what we might do is include some that out of band that maybe use in Hibernate, maybe use EF code only. So I know like EF's gotten a really, really bad rap in the past, and the version, you know, like the specifically the version that's currently 3.5, the version that's in 4.0, I think is a lot better with the ability to do POCO and code only. It'll be interesting to see what perception is of it, because I haven't played with it enough myself to say, you know, whether I think it's awesome or not. I do know that I think it's addressed a lot of the complaints that people have had in the past, but I think there's also a lot of residual angst over EF. And I'm not sure if people are even, it's kind of like once you've turned them away, they sort of don't want to give something a second chance. Then again, maybe they have and they still don't like it. I don't really know where we're at with that, but, you know, I kind of want to see how that plays out. You know, I'm definitely doing some investigations now into the new EF, with its support for POCO and all that. So, you know, I'll probably have a stronger opinion later. So
okay, so how about the auto-injection?
Oh, auto-injection.
Nobody seems to hate Unity, and AutoFac was written by a guy on the .NET framework team, I believe, Nick Bloomhart?
Yeah.
Is that right? Does anyone know about AutoFac? Yeah.
Nick Blumhardt?
Yeah, he just left.
I was going to say. I was like, is that public info? Yeah, he just left. So, yeah, you know, it's funny because I've never used AutoFact, but just the other day, yesterday, I was chatting with Louis DeHarden, the Spark creator, and he was showing me AutoFact. It's pretty cool. I've actually integrated an inject and subtext, and I find it to be pretty cool. So the tricky part here is that, you know, it's something I do, you know, want to bring up again. But, you know, I've brought it up before in our feature team meetings, and it turned out that, like, almost nobody's asking for it. I mean, certainly the very high-end developers, you know, the ones who are very vocal, like, really want it. I mean, I want it. I really want it in there. But when we looked at, like, in general, what feature requests we were getting versus which ones we're not getting, it's very low on the list right now. So, you know, one way to influence that is to go to aspnet.coplex.com, file a bug if there isn't already one in there, and then start voting the hell out of it. And then that will definitely get our attention. So, for example, the most voted bug in CodePlex right now for ASP.NET MVC is the empty project template. So we're addressing that. This one, auto injection, is currently not quite there. And one of the reasons I think it's not there right now is that for most people who care about dependency injection, they actually really care about it. They care about using their tool of choice. So no matter what tool we pick, they're not going to be happy with it because they'll be like, well, you know, you should have used Structure Map, or you should have used Ninject, or you should have used Castle Windsor, you know. And every single one of them will have a very good argument for why their choice is the right choice. So, you know, I just think it's one of those things where for those who care, we can't win. And for those who don't care, well, they don't care. Now, the counter argument to that, of course, is, well, if you put it in there and it's there by default, then the people who don't care might learn to care, you know, just by serendipity. They might run into it and see the beauty of the fact that I just, you know, defined this constructor argument to my controller and it got populated by the right class. And that's kind of my argument for wanting to have something like that in there.
Kind of like the way you encourage people to use testing by creating a test project by default or you know, pushing you towards that in MVC projects.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe in MVC 3, I'll get my way with that particular feature request, especially now that I've told you guys, I've told everyone out there to log a bug, vote it up.
And
just as a plug for our CodePlex site, so we have forums for ASP.NET MVC, and that's kind of where we want general discussion to happen. But we also take a look at, periodically look at the bugs that are logged in our CodePlex site. And if one that has like a huge number of votes, because most of the bugs is like one or two votes each. And it's because it's like one very narrow scenario that one person ran into and no one else cares about it or no one else even understands it. But then there are those few bugs where everyone's like, yeah, this totally affects me. I really need it fixed. So, it does have an impact in how we plan our features. We obviously don't want to alienate our users, and we really want to build the best framework we can. And when we see feature requests where a lot of people are running into the problems, we really want to address it. I mean, we're not, you know, doing this, you know, we don't want to be dicks.
Is that the official ASP.NET stance? We don't want to be dicks.
It's kind of like the Google "Don't be evil" thing.
Don't be a dick.
No, well, because you know what I was gonna say is we want to delight our customers, but doesn't that sound like kind of like that marketing PS, right? But it's true. Like we want happy customers, right? We want you guys to like us.
So I've got a question about kind of this whole procedural bug thing. So for most of the products from Microsoft, we're encouraged to file a bug on Connect, which, you know, has I've had a less than stellar experience with every time I've tried to use it, and I think that a lot of people have too. Most of the time, stuff just gets closed as won't fix or by design, and, you know, that's it. You're done. Do you prefer to get bugs through CodePlex or through Connect? And is it the same team looking at both sets of bugs, I guess? If I file one against MVC on Connect, does that get filtered to your team, or does it get stuck in PSS limbo or something?
No, Connect bugs go directly to the product team. So we had this big process for the big releases where we, it's called a ship room. And if you watch the Hansel Minutes on 9 videos, he actually, Scott Galloway actually talks about this a little bit. And ship room is this like intimidating meeting where you have representatives from all the different teams that are built .NET 4. So the CLR, ASP.NET, you know, the languages teams, and blah, blah, blah. And we get in a room and we look at, and this is what happens near the end as we're getting into like the beta and RC and getting, you know, where we're really like need to close down on the bugs. And so we get in this room together and then we look at everyone's bugs that are left and we go through each one and you bring the bugs that you want to get into the product at this late stage of the, you know, product cycle. And then everyone scrutinizes it and yells at you and then, you know, either approves or disapproves it. And so, those, you know, all the bugs show up in that query, you know. So, like, they'll run a query every day and they'll say, look, your team has, you know, 100 bugs. So, it's very important for us to address bugs that are reported through Connect. So, you know, on that level, you know, Connect is a good way to get our attention because it shows up in our bug counts. Whereas Coplex bugs don't show up in any bug count. So, I'm free to ignore the bug counts without repercussion. You know, internally, as for as long as possible. And so that, you know, and the official answer is we're supposed to push everyone to Connect, right? For MVC, I've always promoted Codeplex because we've been out of band for so long that I'm not used to being in band. And so I personally kind of like Codeplex just because I find it to be kind of a faster interaction cycle and a little more personal, like you're not going through this Connect system. But you know, it's a trade-off. I really feel like Connect will get our attention faster.
For, I mean, most of us on the podcast and most of the people that I think are involved with MVC just either shoot you an email on one of the various lists or just shoot you a mention or a DM on Twitter and say, yeah. Phil, fix this. And then you have the onerous task of going off and convincing the team to implement whatever whack-ass idea we've come up with.
Yeah, it's really interesting because like the number of ways to provide tech support is sort of ballooning, right? There's Stack Overflow, there's our quote unquote official forums, there's Twitter, you know, of course there's emails and all that. And so, you know, on one level, we'd like to kind of like encourage people to go to one place just so we have one place to monitor. But on the other hand, you know, like I'm lazy too, and I'll just ask for support on Twitter, you know, and I love the immediacy of it. And so I try to, you know, scan Twitter as much as I can in Stack Overflow, but the sheer amount is overloading. So it's sometimes like I'll answer one question, but not like three others and, you know, arbitrarily just because, you know, I have a newborn girl and I have a life I have to live, right?
No, you don't.
You're right.
Your entire life is to provide support for me on my tiny little web project. Right.
Yeah.
So let's see. What else? What's your favorite feature, I guess, in MVC2? Do you have one favorite child? Was there anything that you fought for that no one else wanted to support you on and thought you were crazy, and then when it came in, it was the best feature that everyone loved?
Wow. That's a good question. Let's see. I think, you know, the HTML string and IHTML string, I mean, we all, so the ASP.NET team as a whole all wanted to do something about this for a very long time. And we had long, long threads. But eventually it fell to me, you know, as okay, well, since it affects MVC the most, why don't you drive this to completion? We need to come up with a decision. So that's one where, like, you know, as a team, you know, we finally came up with something that seem to work. And so I don't know, like, it's kind of a small feature in that, you know, our helpers now return MVC HTML string rather than just string, and which is technically a break and change. But I'm kind of proud of that because I feel like it addresses like a longstanding security complaint. There's some interesting kind of cool magic that we had to do in order to make that work. And, you know, hopefully it really changes how people write views moving forward and helps them to write them in a more secure fashion. So I think it would be that, the IHTML string and MVC HTML string stuff that we did, and the new HTML encoding code block syntax.
Kevin?
Yeah, so you mentioned Spark earlier, and one of the sort of standard jokey questions you get on Twitter is, when are they just going to make Spark the default view engine and ditch this whole WebForms view engine thing?
Javier Lozano is the one who asked that question, right? That guy, man.
I don't think he's the only one. But, I mean, obviously nobody really expects that to happen, but...
Why not?
Well, we would be thrilled, believe me.
Yeah.
But I'm curious as to whether that, you know, whether at least other view engines like Spark are sort of feeding back stuff into the WebForms view engine, and whether MVC is feeding stuff back into WebForms to sort of, you know, make it better for the MVC users.
I really like Spark, and so I put together this presentation a while back, and I showed it to the ASP.NET team, and they were actually very impressed with Spark. They thought it was really cool. There's some things that are kind of still issues, and it's no fault of Lewis or anyone, in fact, other than the extreme difficulty of writing language services for a mixed language file. And what I mean by that is, if you think of a web form or even Spark, you have two different languages going on there in there, right? You have HTML, and then you have your code language, right, for the code sections. And so for the code sections, you want C-sharp IntelliSense and C-sharp colorization. And for the HTML, you want HTML colorization and HTML IntelliSense. And so there's, I guess, some magic that makes it work for web forms that is very hard to do if you're not very hard to do outside of Visual Studio. So Lewis, you know, is crazy smart guy. And he, as my wife likes to say, he's scary smart. And he got the code nugget language services to work with Spark. But when you get that to work, then you lose the HTML IntelliSense. Whereas you could also just open Spark as an HTML file and get HTML IntelliSense and not get the code IntelliSense. And so, you know, one of the things that we would really like to see, and you know, trying to get them in touch with the right people to make it work, is to figure out, is it even possible, maybe not in VS08, but VS10, to get both of those IntelliSense working. So that's one thing I hope that we can get working. The other thing is, you know, like, if we don't, maybe we won't include it in the default because, you know, the familiarity of web forms as a view engine, you know, can't be overstated, right? But, you know, there are other options, right? Can we make it very easy to grab it? Because one of the other things I did is I created the default project that you get when you create a new MVC project, and I replaced all the views with Spark. And it was really nice and clean. So, and I showed that around, you know. So I think a lot of people really like it. We're just trying to figure out what's the best way to, I think, like, so the way I should say is, the ASP.NET team, I think we're all kind of in agreement that we really would love to expose people to it so that, you know, they realize that there's this really cool alternative if they like that approach better than what we have. We're just trying to figure out what the best way to expose it is. Do we include it in the box, but just it's not the default? I mean, is that enough? Or do we have it on a web PI, or do we do some other thing? So we're looking at a lot of options for that. But yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan, and, you know, hopefully maybe a few people who've never heard of Spark will try it out because they heard me talk about it.
Yes, and we did do a show with Lewis about Spark, which was awesome.
Yep.
So you mentioned the Spark, obviously, and that's cool to hear, you know, that you're looking at other projects out there and seeing what people are doing with MVC and how they're adding on to it and stuff. Obviously, since MVC is like built for extensibility, that's cool and expected. What are some other projects that you're looking at and taking any inspiration from? Like, I don't know, like FUBU MVC, or are there, you know, just other things that you mentioned, XVAL, I don't know, AutoMapper, anything else that's kind of like getting you thinking about stuff?
Anything Steve Sanderson is doing is kind of interesting, right? So the XVAL stuff we're looking at, and, you know, thinking, how can we take it further? You know, some of the concepts there. Sharp architecture is something that I haven't looked at too closely, but I need to, and MVC Turbine, sort of that, kind of the things you and I already just talked about, which is, can we have more auto injection? You know, a la the AutoFact style of doing things. So that's something that, you know, I think would be interesting to look at. Because I think, you know, with MVC2, we've added a lot of these dynamic data style features and a lot of this extensibility and validation and all that stuff. And I think for MVC3, one of the things I want to look at is, you know, can we address some of the more componentization type stuff? Not like controls, you know, or anything, but more like composability and such. You know, it's not something that MVC has 100% addressed very well, but that's something that, you know, I'd like to, you know, kind of look at, especially like, you know, in the plumbing level of things, like some of those conventions. Yeah, I mean, I try to keep on top of, you know, a lot of these other frameworks, both on .NET and not on .NET, kind of to see where, you know, where they're going and what kind of things they're addressing. Also, like, I think the other thing that's helping is, you know, just doing app building, you know, myself. So, you know, as some of you guys might know, I run an open source blog engine called the Subtext, you know, shameless plug. I'm always looking for contributors, but one of the things I've done recently is I rewrote all the URL mappings in Subtext to use my own custom routing for web form type things, because Subtext was, you know, a web forms app. It's very old in terms of its code base. But I've been slowly kind of rewriting huge aspects of the code base. So now it's actually a hybrid app where portions of it are using MVC controllers and portions of it are using web forms. And, you know, ultimately I'll probably rewrite it. And I think that's going to be the best way for me to really learn what the limitations of our framework and what our framework, you know, some of the things our framework really needs to smooth the development is by really building a big application using MVC and kind of extracting ideas out of that. So, you know, fortunately, we have a lot of, you know, people, both internal and external, building applications who are providing good feedback. But I really need to get that, like, personal touch of writing a big application with it, you know, to really kind of get deeper in terms of what kind of things we want to do.
Well, that was one of the reasons that I'd mentioned the auto wiring and the auto injection was when I worked on the Jupyter Images site. As you know, it was one of the things that was set up when I got there, and I never had to think about it again. I just, you know, if we needed to add a new dependency to the controller or to anything really in the project, we just added it and, you know, compiled and it ran. We didn't have to go through and change some XML file or do some kind of fluent interface mapping in some, you know, class somewhere. And I think that you'll find that that convention in itself saves you so much time and effort. Mm-hmm. And I spent the first week worried that I wasn't doing it right and trying to figure out where I needed to do all this wiring up at. And then I realized I don't.
Right.
And I think as you start to get more into it, you realize that that's a convention that is just so handy to have.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One thing, you know, maybe what I should look at is building a little controller factory that picks, you know, what maybe AutoFac or whatever, and put it in our MVC features library. And that particular controller factory would be called the auto injecting coding controller factory or whatever, right? The, you know, auto dependency resolving controller factory. I'll come up with a real Microsofty name, like the enterprise auto injecting dependency resolver controller factory, R2. And put that in the features, and, you know, like, if, because another way we kind of gauge features is like we put in the features, and if a lot of people really love it, then we'll be like, okay, we should pull that into the core. Like for example, strongly typed input helpers are coming into the core because a lot of people really like them. So yeah, and I agree with you. I think that kind of thing is really nice when you're building app. You know, the other thing is, you know, like we have to be careful not to overload the framework, right? Like, one of the benefits of the framework is it's relatively simple, you know. And, you know, like, is that a feature that really belongs in the framework, or is it really something that should be done on a case-by-case, you know, basis? I really like that, and I kind of want it in the framework, because I don't want to have to set that up on every new project. You know what I mean?
Yes. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, you're the one who told me, yeah.
So, I was thinking I would introduce a new segment of the show called this new unhurting code called Abusive Questions from Twitter. And I think right now, if I'm feeling you know, like some energy this week, there may even be a theme song or theme music behind this.
Dude, that'd be awesome. Could my show be the one that introduces the theme music?
I think that would be good. So awesome.
Is this the inaugural edition of
Abusive Questions from Twitter?
Abusive Questions from Twitter. You know, we have had Abusive Questions from Twitter before, but it wasn't an official feature. So I think right now we're creating that.
Wow, I feel special.
Yes.
And that's so good, because even I have one tonight from Twitter.
So this week's Abusive Question from Twitter comes from Alan Stevens, and he said, "Why should we bother with ASP.NET at all if we have a question of other web stacks? Seriously." I asked him more about that later, like, well, are you talking, you know, different? And he's just saying, like, if somebody new starting on web development, why should they care about ASP.NET? So I don't know what's the... He said someone asked him that question recently, and he didn't have a great answer for it. What would you say to somebody that's like, okay, I've got all these other frameworks. What's the selling point of ASP.NET? Abusive question from Twitter.
So... You know, I could give you the marketing shill answer. I could give you my consultant hat answer, right? If I put on my consultant hat, I would ask, well, what's important to you, right? So, for example, is, you know, your being able to choose languages important to you? Or, you know, do one of these frameworks that you like is already written in the language, or already you can use the language you already like, right? So, for example, if you're a Ruby fan, then you might just pick Rails, right? Because it's just kind of a natural fit. But if you're, you know, if you really like statically typed languages like C# or VB.NET or, you know, whatever, you know, then you won't be able to use, that kind of rules out a lot of those. So language choice is one aspect. I think when you're talking about ASP.NET compared to other web stacks, you also want to look at the entire platform, right? The .NET framework is very rich and mature, and, you know, mature can be both good and bad, right? But the good aspects of being mature is that, you know, a huge number of bugs have hopefully been wrinkled out. It's proven to scale and have pretty good performance. And there's a, you know, pretty much a library for anything that you might want to do. You know, sometimes those libraries are harder to use than they need to be in the framework. But a lot of people that really like the .NET framework really like the fact that it's also all in one place, right? You just go, you get it, it's all there. And, you know, you get the IDE and, you know, you can get productive fairly quickly with that combo. But then there are those who are kind of philosophically opposed to that whole, you know, I need an IDE to be productive, right? And this is something, you know, we're even looking at, like, you know, with MVC, like, I'd like you to be productive even without the MVC tooling, but the MVC tooling is just sort of value add. I mean, that's the goal. We're trying to design the features in such a way that you don't need tooling to do them, but the tooling just makes you feel happier and better, more productive, right? So, I you know, there's sort of like so many arguments you could throw at it, right? Like there's the philosophical argument. You know, some people just really want to use a dynamic language. And even if you choose a dynamic language, you can still run it. You know, there's Iron Ruby, Iron Python, there's Boo. You get a lot of choices in the .NET framework. But so going back to my point, like, so A, everything is there, you know, in the box typically that you might need. Whereas a lot of times with these other stacks, you have to really kind of pick and choose all these components from all these different places. And, you know, that can get kind of tricky at times. Although, you know, the same could be said if the things in the box for .NET don't, you know, meet your needs. It really just comes down to, like, you know, I think there's a lot of compelling reasons to use ASP.NET. I think MVC and even WebForms, for those who like that model of development, are very productive. The tooling is really fantastic. Yeah, the IDE is great. Performance is good. Yeah, there's a really rich community around it. You know, I really like the people I interact with. And there's a lot of material coming out of Microsoft that helps people learn how to use it. At the same time, you know, I actually like a lot of these other web stacks as well. You know, I used to do a little bit of Rails development, never done any PHP development or anything like that. And I think there's a lot of compelling reasons to use these alternative frameworks too. But, you know, ultimately, I think people will decide based on what sort of fits their style of development. You know, like, I know some people like to pit things as the one true way such as dynamic languages are the one true way or static languages are the one true way. And I really don't buy that because you meet equally smart people on both sides of the fence. And a lot of times what you find is that they're sort of borrowing elements from each other already, right? Like C sharp is getting a little more dynamic and functional, whereas other functional languages or dynamic languages might get a little more static, you know, in certain cases. Yeah, so I mean, just kind of, if it fits you like a glove, then, you know, wear it.
So, the point I made to Alan was that, you know, he said, well, why would you use ASP.NET over, like, Python or Ruby? I said, well, those are languages, and there's lots and lots of different web stacks in there, and they all have different benefits and you know, kind of areas that they hit. You know, MERB is different than Rails, is different than Sinatra, is different than Rack, and that's just in Ruby.
Yep.
It's not even talking about Python and Cake PHP and everything in there. So it's a huge
I think a lot of times, like, what ultimately determines which one you use is either what you use in college or what jobs were available when, you know, you entered the job market, right?
And what kind of person you are too.
Yeah, and
if you're the kind that likes to experiment and
like if you're a good person or a bad person.
Yeah, if you're a good person, you use ASP.NET, and if you're evil, you'll use those other ones.
If you're evil, you use web forms.
If you hate America, you'll use those other frameworks. I think you should try multiple frameworks, like, in the end, right? Like, I think, a well-rounded web developer will not only know one framework, and that will help you decide on which one's the best for you.
Unless you work at Microsoft and you are forbidden from staring at the evil open source code from other languages.
Well, I don't have to look at the Rails source code to use Rails.
Yeah, actually you kind of do sometimes because you don't know what the hell is going on.
Okay, true.
Sorry. Did I slam Rails? I'm sorry. I'll move on. I'm in a Python mood lately.
Blasphemy, man. I thought Rails was like untouchable, man.
So I got a question from David Starr, Elegant Coder. You know David?
No. Should I?
Yeah. He does the Elegant Codecast.
ElegantCoder.com?
I don't know. He's Elegant Coder on Twitter.
Oh, David Starr. Let me just do a search here.
Yeah, he works for Pluralsight.
Oh, you know, David Starr, you do a search for that and you get Star of David on Wikipedia, of course. Pluralsight?
Yeah, he works for Pluralsight.
I've heard of
him. He runs
ElegantCode.com.
He's out of Boise, yeah. So anyway, his question is, can you name the person in the office across the hall from you? Have you ever met him? Ooh, he even knows it to him.
Well, yeah, chances are, right? No, so right across from the hall, yeah, that would be Stefan Schakow, and he runs... He actually handles a lot of the core of ASP.NET. So he's the guy you talk to when you want to know about our new extensibility for plugging in other caching engines like Velocity or I'm blanking on the one. And like if you wanted to plug in some sort of Memcache or Velocity into as the cache provider for ASP.NET and that sort of thing, all the low level stuff in ASP.NET, he's the PM that runs that. He's also, like, our security dude. That was an easy question. I mean, assuming he means, like, literally, if I step out of my door, walk, you know, across the hall, you know, like, opposite the hallway, that's Stefan.
I'm not coming up with new theme song music for easy questions from Twitter.
Yeah, come on,
David. I'm just not.
David,
well,
seriously.
Well, come on.
This is supposed to be
the
abusive questions. That was like a big, fat softball. Knock that one out.
You know the culture. You know the culture at Microsoft. That was a well-founded question. A lot of these people don't know the people across the hall.
Press conference, but I didn't want to get political.
Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. I have a question, but it's not an abusive question from Twitter. A while back, you gave some indication that you were trying to drive some interest, adoption, awareness of TDD in the sort of larger .NET framework developer community where, you know, looking at areas of the framework itself that could be changed or improved to make TDD workflows more, you know, more amenable. I'm just curious whether anything has come out of that in the .NET 4.0 sort of time frame.
Yeah, so a couple things. So there's the on the Visual Studio side, and you'll see Scott Guthrie blog about this, sort of using Visual Studio with MVC to do TDD. Some of the new features of Visual Studio, like where you have sort of that less aggressive IntelliSense that fits more of the TDD workflow. One of the problems with the current or the previous IntelliSense is that if you're, you know, typing like product, but you haven't yet defined product, and there's another class called, you know, product foo or something, then, you know, it gets a little too aggressive and you can't like type in the class name of the class you will write later because you're writing the test first. So, you know, we looked at areas, ways to make the sort of the test first workflow a bit nicer in Visual Studio. Regarding the framework itself, well, you know, there's MVC, aspects of web forms, you know, new development in web forms, all pretty much the general policy on the ASP.NET team is that everything, every check-in has unit tests that correspond to them. So, you know, there's more of that going on our team. You know, getting other teams to adopt that, that has been, you know, somewhat kind of challenging. Not everyone's, you know, fully bought into that sort of workflow. But, you know, one of the things that I was trying to focus on is even if you're not bought in, you know, let's try to make it work for your customers if possible. But, you know, that's obviously a challenge that if you're not bought into it, how do you make it work for your customers? But, I mean, I think we've seen some efforts, like some of the stuff work was done out of band, like the model view model. So, you know, I talked with Glenn Block and Jeff Hanley over there about, you know, can we get some of the, you know, make it easier for those who want to do these sort of pattern oriented development in Silverlight or in WPF and who want to do TDD. So we had, you know, I talked to them a lot. So, you know, some of that maybe didn't make it into the core framework, but at least you're seeing efforts happen out of band there. And then with the Entity Framework guys, you know, the whole POCO, where you can just use a plain old, you know, CLR object or C# object with your, you know, Entity Framework, that makes certain scenarios with EF a lot more testable for, you know, the end user developer. So I think we're seeing a lot of improvements, and hopefully, you know, Scott Gu's upcoming blog post, he'll, you know, cover some of that and show off some of the cool improvements to the TDD workflow. I think that the just the big change overall is that, you know, a lot of people are thinking about this and talking about this and realizing that this is, you know, more and more, this is what customers want, and which is a good thing, because I think, you know, even if, you know, like 5 years ago, it, you know, you might say, well, it's the right thing, but, you know, customers weren't even asking for it, I imagine, at least from what I hear. But nowadays, you know, customers really are asking for it. So it's a good change.
So I was thinking, you mentioned earlier about subtext a little bit. I know K-Scott just upgraded or converted at least his blog over to subtext. K-Scott, I just wondered if you had any thoughts or, you know, impressions or whatever on that process.
I feel much closer to Phil now that I've been through all the code in subtext. No, but actually it was...
All the good stuff is mine and all the bad stuff is legacy. Just kidding.
That's what I assumed. It was actually a semi-painful process, but that wasn't any fault of subtext. That was just because I had gone so long just letting my blog run on its current software that I had to do a little bit extra work to get running on subtext. And I would say that subtext actually helped out a lot, because I found it easy to go in and understand the schema and understand some things that were happening in the code that I had to adjust to. So,
oh, good, good.
It was cool.
Yeah, I'm, you know, when I started subtext, it was obviously forked off of the .text code base. And I, one of the things that, I don't know if you remember .text, but installing that was really painful.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And my goal, like initially, was I wanted this to be brain dead simple to install and really, really easy. And so I spent a lot of time focused on that. Like there was four, you know, web.config files that you had to pick the right one, and I
merged
one and all that. The web PI now makes it even easier. The web platform installer that we ship that from Microsoft makes it even easier if you are installing on a machine that you can actually run web PI against. And hopefully soon, like as hosting providers start supporting, you know, MS Deploy, it'll be very easy to install it, you know, run web PI locally and then deploy to your IIS server and maybe make things easier on me. The next version of Subtext, I'm getting very close. I've only got a few high priority bugs that I want to fix, and then I'm gonna go through a period of time where I'm just doing some perf and stress testing and really try to make it run faster than before. But I've spent a lot of time refactoring a lot of code, rewriting a lot of code, cleaning up a lot of code, and just really addressing a lot of niggling issues. And I've added a little dashboard to the next version that has some default stats in there that, you know, are kind of the common things you want to know. And some of those were inspired by Allende's, I always call them the Allende stats or something like that. He had posted a query that he runs to figure out his most popular post. And I basically took that query and said, look, I'm putting that in Subtext in the dashboard. And he's seen a screenshot and he's really excited about this release. So I really need to, you know, get it out there so that people can try it out. But I haven't added a huge number of new features, but, you know, I've just tried to look at like kind of glaring issues, and the routing stuff, I think, is really cool that now it's now all running on the routing infrastructure. And I think this next release will be really nice because I've also looked at bug farms, you know, like the areas of code where like you're always getting bugs, and I pretty much either rewrote or refactored those. Mm-hmm. So hopefully this will be the fastest, most solid, and most fun release of Subtext yet. So, and always looking for contributors.
Well, we run Subtext as our blogging engine over at DevCentral at f5.com.
Oh, cool.
And so I may be diving into it some here.
Do you guys run like the multi-blog setup there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the areas where there's a lot of kind of traditional bugs, and I spent a lot of time pretty much fixing all reported bugs having to do with like community style sites. So that should hopefully be good news for you guys.
Yeah, we're going to.
Yeah, I'm actually running multi-blogs on mine, just because I had some old legacy blogs that I didn't want to get rid of.
Uh-huh.
And it's worked out well for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So
really my issue was,
go ahead.
The one thing, the biggest issue I have with Subtext was the email wasn't working for me. It took me a while to get that configured. I actually sent you a little patch for that.
Simple
one line change.
Oh, was it the thing where the port zero default thing or?
Yes. Somewhere?
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. I applied your patch, and
most of my work was spent getting data out of my old blog engine into BlogML and getting it imported into Subtext.
Yeah, so I rewrote our BlogML support, and in doing so, I found several bugs with the BlogML implementation. And Kaven Nayeri, I'm probably mutilating his name, but he actually just released a new version of BlogML that incorporates like some of those bug fixes. It's really interesting because the reason I got into Subtext is I wasn't really enjoying the work that I was doing in my day job, because sometimes it gets repetitive when you're a consultant, right? You're doing the same thing over and over, data in, data out, blah, and you really want to play around with new technologies, but, you know, all your clients are on the old legacy stuff. So I figured, you know, Subtext would be my outlet for that. And I think, you know, in many ways, me getting involved in open source in general has really helped my professional development and my professional development along, and my my development skills along. And so in doing so, I've been able to play around with a lot of different, you know, open source technologies and a lot of cool frameworks, and finding bugs in a lot of them. I think I have a gift for like trying to do things that that break things. So I've actually submitted a patch to Log4Net, which they've accepted, but they haven't yet produced a release that includes that patch. I've submitted a bunch of tests to SGML Reader, which we use, and I found some bugs in BlogML. So you know, in some small way, hopefully this next release of Subtext has also had a benefit on all these other open source projects just because it's exposed these bugs.
I know, too, back with OpenID support that ran into issues with that and submitted some things back to .NET OpenID.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which was cool. Yeah, I ran into some problems with that, too, like with Medium trust issues, which I think maybe just my lack of configuration knowledge. But the .NET open source ecosystem, like you look at, I was on olo.net the other day, and it's kind of this open source community site. And you can do these reports based on languages in terms of the activity, commit activity in all these source control repositories for open source. And it's not necessarily a scientific survey because, you know, olo.net is, I don't know if it's, you know, indexing the majority of open source projects out there or not. But just as kind of a pulse on the scene, so to speak, you know, Java is just way up there in terms of the open source activity, whereas all the other languages, you know, Ruby, C Sharp, Python, are kind of just, you know, down at the bottom trailing Java. And you realize that Java has a very old, very rich open source ecosystem. The .NET community isn't quite on par with that yet. That's something I'd love to see change, and I think, you know, we're working towards that sort of thing. And but you know, just, you know, when I look at things now compared to, like, you know, several years ago when I was first starting out, you know, there's a lot of cool open source projects on .NET, and I really enjoy working with all these other projects, right? I really being able to send feature requests to Nate Kohari about Ninject or play around with Log4Net or this or that. So just the exposure to all these different projects, and that's been kind of a really cool aspect of working on Subtext, is just working in the open source community in general, and really like learning a lot from these other projects.
So one thing with Subtext, and I know I talked to you and this had been on the discussion list beforehand, but it's still got the database layer is kind of hand coded or uses a lot of, you know, I mean, it all goes against stored procedures. And I wondered if that's something that, you know, as ORMs continue to get better and better on the .NET platform, if that's like on the horizon to do
John,
anything.
John, stored procedures is the way God intended you to access a database.
I'm going to edit that out.
No, you're going to put it in there, but leave it out of context, right?
Right.
Phil says, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I kind of wanted to do it in this release, but I decided to take a step back and not bite off way too much. But, you know, like the next release, I'll probably look at, you know, finally choosing a better data access story. I mean, the hard part is like everything's working, right? And everything works pretty well.
Right,
it's like,
right.
It's hard to go in there and do that. But I have run into one of the things I did do is it used to be really bad where we had sort of like multiple abstractions. You had a object provider and then you had a data provider. And so then you had a concrete, you know, database object provider and then a SQL data provider. And so you had these multiple levels of abstraction. So if you wanted to add a column to a table and float that all the way up, you had to like change all these freaking classes. So I've moved it down to just one level of abstraction. There's an object provider and then there's a concrete implementation of that. And really that object provider is going to become sort of more of a repository. But, and that's been great, and that's coming out in the next release. So at least I've streamlined it a little bit. But then, down the road, I really need to pick some better data access layers so that I don't have to make 20 changes every time I want to change my schema a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, I do. That was when I did that small .NET OpenID thing. I spent more time doing the plumbing.
Yeah, and that
to, you know, make those
and
changes.
Got to get more dry. Like it's just way too wet.
Yeah. Cool. So we're at like an hour and a half. I think we can probably edit out, you know, that includes other stuff that can be cut
I'm
out.
Yeah, sure,
plenty
but... to cut. Just anything that makes me sound stupid, you know.
Well,
anything that's
that
not
case,
funny,
we
should have a 5-minute show.
Should we talk about Codeplex Foundation, or I don't think that we need more filler. I'm just, if you wanted to talk about it, we could.
You know, if you have questions, I'd be happy to talk about it. Otherwise, I mean, I know there's already been a lot out there, and it's kind of old news already. So
yeah,
what's up to you guys?
64 days down? What is it? 36 days down?
Yep.
In the first 100.
Yeah, it's only one third of the way, man. A lot is happening behind the scenes, so I think there'll be some interesting announcements, you know, when as they get closer to the 100 days. They're getting a lot of feedback, right? And a lot of this feedback is coming from some heavyweights in open source foundations, right? People from the various foundations like Apache or whatever. And so they're taking it to heart and they're like, you know, working very hard to address this and then try to, you know, come out with some new stuff. So just because you're not hearing anything, it doesn't mean that nothing's happening. It's more like, oh, they're hearing some very strong messages and they need to really process it. You know what I mean?
And, you know, I really think they need to go back and listen to our interview with Ted Leung way back when we first started, because we talked about a lot of this stuff, too. And Ted's a smart guy. He's been with the Apache Foundation for, like, ever.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember being on the first advisory board meeting, and I was, like, talking with, you know, the guy who founded MySQL and the guy who founded this and that, and realized, like, wow, these are the adults in the room, as they like to say, yeah, as the phrase goes, right? Like the adults in the room when it comes to open source, right? So yep. it was kind of a, you know, it's kind of intimidating, but it's very cool to really hear the stories of these guys who've been doing this for, you know, a very long time.
It's always interesting.
And here's the thing, they don't agree, right? You know, so that's nice. Also the challenge, right? No, you know, you got a lot of smart guys who can't agree on a data access layer. They're not going to agree on exactly what to do. So, you know, nothing is, whatever the foundation does, it's not going to please everyone. But I think the main thing is that people need to be, as long as they make it clear that people have been heard and, you know, they made a decision based on what they think is best, but they did consider all these alternatives and they're listening, you know, it's not one of these, you know, things where they're just ignoring this feedback, thinking they already know what's best. I mean, that's very much not what's happening. At least I hope.
Well, one of the things that I always find interesting when I'm looking at or talking about .NET open source is just how young it all is. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you think about what's the most popular open source .NET project right now?
Uh-huh.
You know, there's probably, probably Subtext. It's probably one of them, and Hibernate. And you look at how many users there are of those products, not you know, counting your MySpace China monstrosity huge win. but even counting that, and you compare the numbers to something like Apache or MySQL,
yeah.
And you realize just how small potatoes the .NET OSS space is right now, and how mm-hmm. wide open it is for more projects.
Yeah. Well, you know, it'd be interesting to see those numbers. I would imagine like Log4Net would be one of the biggest in terms of most used, just because it's so used in so many other, like, if you, for example, Subtext uses Log4Net, so would you count all the Subtext users as Log4Net users, right, in some fashion? Or and then there's the you know, like ASP.NET MVC is open source, so, you know, we've got, you know, a decent number of users. So hopefully as Microsoft, you know, starts doing more of this kind of thing, like Meth is open source, Microsoft Ajax is open source, and the Ajax control toolkit are all open source. So Microsoft has some of the biggest, you know, open source projects as well. And Hibernate is, you know, like you said, that one comes to mind. You know, I wonder if Castle Windsor, like, probably has a huge following. So, but yeah, then you compare it to MySQL. Yeah, it's like there's no comparison there.
10:30. Been up since 4. No more question.
All right. I know my
you know
my daughter's not She's got a cold, so she's got that like congestion where like she can't really eat for that long, so she wants to eat every single minute.
Yep. Yep. Nice. I went through that too.
It's almost like I just want to stay here and work on the computer all night, so that, because I, if I go to bed, then I'll get woken up.
It's we call that baby roulette. It's like, do I go to sleep now? Will she wake up in 20 minutes or an hour? Or will it only be 5 minutes?
Yeah, because if it's in an hour, I might be able to fall asleep and sleep through the wake up.
No matter what, it'll feel like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. Cool. Okay. I'm going to seize this opportunity to wrap up the call. Interrupt. Now you guys are talking like normal humans, and we really try and stick to just talking like dorks. Okay. So thanks a bunch, Phil, for taking this could be sleep time to talk to us.
No problem.
And all right, that's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. Catch us next week when we. I don't know, do something.
You guys talk to Rob Connery again, who's going to want to defend his good name against me.
That's right.
Yeah, take that, Rob.
Okay. Right. Awesome. Where should we start, Phil? Do you want to tell a joke about Rob Connery?
Yeah, I've got a bit of an axe to grind with you guys. Well, or with Rob, because I generally don't listen to a lot of podcasts, but I happened to catch Rob Connery's interviewing you guys on a whim, and he was talking some smack about me. So I thought I would let you guys in on the real reason he left Microsoft. So you guys all know that Rob kind of has that like Aloha guy Hawaiian imagery, right? That sort of persona that he conveys, right?
Yes. Although he's actually from California. He's a transplant. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, he's like, I live in Kauai, and I'm surfing all the time. Well, we found out it's a lie. And, in fact, he's from Canada.
Yeah, but he's a Howley. He knows.
He's a what?
A Howley.
He's a Howley, and he knows it.
Well,
I thought you said Rob's a halibut.
See if we can find
him. Well, even if he's from Hawaii, he'd always be a Howley. That goes without saying.
Now, wait a minute. Phil just made a really damning accusation, and we're just glossing over it. You are calling Rob Connery a Canadian?
Yeah, and so the way we found out is that he had iTunes installed and, you know, accidentally turned on the Share Your Playlist, and it was full of Celine Dion music.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was so embarrassed because every meeting would start with snickering that he decided he had to leave. True story.
Ouch. We should ring him
look up. It up in Wikipedia.
Surely
in
there is no other
7 minutes exactly.
Is that how long the waiting period is on Wikipedia?
No, that's just when I'm trying to time it.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it's supposed to be spelled H-A-O-L-E or something like that, or I-E.
H-A-O-L-I-E.
Sorry. Okay, so I need to stop commenting on the side commentary, huh?
Yes. Yes,
okay,
you
so
do.
You can edit that part out.
Yes. Okay.
So it's good to be on, guys. What do you guys want to ask me? What do you have?
Well, the obvious thing is ASP.NET MVC 2.